everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today, my interview is with Alexander Sichel from Maison Sichel. And they are a négociant company. They own many important wineries, including Chateau Palmer, one of the most famous wines of Bordeaux. Going to be part of a new endeavor to make wine in southern France. We talk about that. Just a really interesting guy. And also, whenever you get a chance to talk with someone from Maison Sichel, he was visiting in Toronto a couple months ago. I'm always going to do it because they represent great wine. They represent Bordeaux, and we talk a lot of Bordeaux, and who doesn't want to talk about Bordeaux on a wine podcast? What I want to talk about before we start is someone tweeted me out this article from Wine Folly, and it's a great, fun article I would recommend. And the title is Stop Saying These 12 Things About Wine. And there's one in particular, and I don't know if I've talked about it in the past. I know I talk about it in some future interviews because I've got a bunch of them saved that I'm going to release. And again, I'm debating starting to release two of these a week. I realized one of the things they said I really need to work on for this podcast. And it's the final tip they give. And the tip is basically stop with the overly flowery wine notes. And like, and the one they use is this. This wine tastes like morning mist rolling down the hillsides, transforming into dewdrops on the grass. And of course, they're making fun of, you know, when we see those wine tasting notes. And you'll get them from time to time. And I realized something. I do that from time to time. And I love making fun of the wine industry. And yet, I'm guilty of it as well. And I was talking about this with my partner from my other podcast, Bob Makowitz. And I realized that because I take wine sometimes so seriously, I forget to just have fun with it more. And I think I've done that on this podcast. And I think I'll probably still be guilty of it when you're just doing tastings. And what I mean is, you know, when you get a little too technical on semi-bruised green fruit, I make fun of it when other people do it, but I realize I do it myself. And in my other life as a broadcaster for TSN Radio, I always love to poke holes in our industry because we take it so seriously. And in the end, it's a game. It's supposed to be fun. But I do. So I always like making fun of it and sort of taking the usual sports tropes, trying to flip them upside down, showing you what's really going on, sometimes the hypocrisy of it, and all that kind of stuff. All I'm trying to do is to show people what's really going on behind the curtain in sports and that really you don't need to be as serious. So why don't I do that in wine? And the only explanation I could think of is I just have so much respect for the winemakers and for wine and the business and for every part of it. Then and so many people that I know that I've interviewed who give these crazy tasting notes. And I love hearing when they do it and breaking it down. So I almost want to honor them when I have to realize that's not really 100% who I am. And on my Instagram account, I was over at a friend's place and we were drinking some old Bordeaux and it was a great night and I threw out a couple Instagrams and I was just trying to explain what the wines tasted like. And my girlfriend said to me, like, why are you doing it like that? Like, you're supposed to, you're here for, you know, to make it a little bit lighter, a little bit easier. And also you're funny, you know, and that's hard for her to admit. She hates admitting that I'm funny. She does her best not to laugh at some of my jokes. Of course, if you hear a lot of my jokes, it's actually quite easy not to laugh at them. And I realized, I'm like, yeah, you're right. So I'm going to try going forward when I talk about wines to be a little bit more relatable because that is kind of the point of this podcast. So I wanted to sort of mention that. A couple other things on this list that I love. Like when people say, I only drink blank, get out of that. Get out of there right now. I only drink, you know, Cabernet. I only drink Pinot Noir. Stop that. It also says, don't tell people, you know, or be nice to people when they mispronounce names. I'm all for that. I study wine. I mispronounce names all the time. People are shocked I even get Gewürztraminer correct. Anyone out there, sweet wines are not something childish. These are incredibly well-made wines that just have sugar in them, but they're balanced. The acid is there. So your Port, your Sauternes, your Tokaj, these are just super delicious, rich, you know, lots of expressive fruit. These are just fun, impressive things to drink. It's like it's like drinking what apricot was meant to be, but only if you throw it in some hazelnut and, you know, sometimes some, you know, a little bit of tropical fruit to it. You know, and they're fantastic. Or port. My God, the nuttiness and the hazelnut and, you know, and a little bit of leather. It's just delicious. Also, never rip on someone or wines for a screw cap. That's ridiculous. I mean, there's even Burgundy. There's some wine producers in Burgundy, like high-level Premier Grand Cru Burgundy, that are using screw caps. And you'll try a lot of wine from New Zealand and Australia that will blow you away. So there's a bunch of other ones. I'd recommend going and reading Wine Folly, Stop Saying These 12 Things About Wine. And I'll give you a little mini wine review. And as I was talking, I wasn't going to do this. I just grabbed a bottle. It's a Grand Cru from Henri Bourriet, his Courton Charlemagne 2007. And it's a Chardonnay, and it's one of the best bottles I've ever had. But part of the reason why this is one of the best bottles of wine I ever had, beyond the fact that, damn, you know, it's Grand Cru, it's a great producer from a great area, and, you know, had a couple of years of age on it. I opened it 2 years ago, was that I opened this wine on New Year's Eve, and it was a super cold year. It was 2 years ago, if you remember, just how freezing it was in southern Ontario. And I was up at my girlfriend's cottage, and we built a fire. So we had a fire going, and we were out there watching the sunset on the final day of, I believe it was 2016. And so on the final day of 2016, right by the water, gorgeous night, really cold, but having the fire there to keep you warm, it was great. And we drank this. So this was the wine we had with the final sunset of 2016. And I mean, what I remember from this wine was it just kept doing different things. You know, like when you smell it, you're getting these rich Chardonnay notes that you would expect from Burgundy. And then as you're drinking it and powerful in the mid, you know, as it's going down, I won't say the mid palate, as it's going down, it's doing different things. And then it's lingering at the end. And it is a lot of these like apples and a little bit of tropical notes and a little bit of honey. And you know, there's all of these different things. And it was this wonderful, beautiful wine that, like, when you hear the idea, this wine spoke to me. That can sound so douchey. I get it. But I think what people mean by that is that the wine is constantly having a conversation, meaning that it tastes different on the way down. You know, that it does different things. As, like, think of it as the beginning and the middle and the end. And a lot of wines, and there's nothing wrong with it, it tells one little story. And it sort of tastes the same as you're sipping it, as you're swallowing it, and as you're thinking about the wine moments later. But this wine, it gave you a different story at the start, at the middle, and at the end. And it stuck with you. So that's what I remember about that wine. And that might be a better wine description than going over 12 different fruit notes with some spice and this or that. So as I say, it's something I'm always going to be debating with myself about. But going forward, I will try to be a little bit more fun and try to make my wine notes, when I'm talking about them, make it a little bit more relatable. Because if you want the hardcore stuff, Guildsom, they got great stuff. Levy Dalton, there's a lot of your really professional Somme wine podcasts where you can go and get that. I'm still trying to provide something a little bit different to the wine drinker. All right, so that's it of my cold open and my little rant. But coming up now, again, from Maison Chichel, it is Alex Chichel. Thanks for listening.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Matthew Cos here for another episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today, one of the people behind some of the most iconic wines in France from Maison Seychelles. It is Alex Seychelles. Alex, thank you so much for being a part of this podcast.
Thank you very much, Matt, for having me. This is great.
So before we get into your title and everything that you're doing with Seychelles, just for people who don't know the wineries that you guys overlook, the wines that you guys make, I was wondering if you could sort of give a bit of an overview.
Yes. So we've been involved in the wine business for 7 generations now, and we are involved in so 2 sides. The first one being the wines that we produce, the wineries we manage. So we have 4 wineries, so Château Palmer in Margaux, Château Engludé also located in Margaux, Château Argadins in Bordeaux Supérieur, so that's southern part of Bordeaux, and Château Triol in the southern part of Corbière. Mm-hmm. The other side of the business that we're involved in is the wine trade, and that's the oldest side of the business. We've been representing all of the Bordeaux wines, so entry level to the most iconic wines of Bordeaux since 1883, and we still do that.
And what is your title? What is your responsibility? Because you guys are a large family or a famous French wine family, so I'm just curious, just your responsibilities.
So I've been through different responsibilities for the family business. I started out as selling wines to Bordeaux restaurants. Then for 4 years, I worked with my uncle, James, and I've been overlooking the sales in Northern America. And today, now I'm responsible for one of our estates, so Château Triol in the southern part of France.
Okay, and we'll get to southern France, and I want to geek out on Bordeaux with you because I got you here, and I mean, how could I not?
Yes.
I'm first curious, just what's the biggest differences, would you say, in terms of the French wine consumer versus North America? In terms of preference, styles that they prefer, if you're going to do a profile of your classic French drinker versus someone here in North America.
Well, it's a difficult question because I found out the newer generations of Americans who are drinking wine prefer the wines that are probably bigger, mm-hmm. a bit more sweeter. But when I talk with professionals who are in the business for a long time, they tend to prefer more drier wines, more the style of what we produce in France, in Bordeaux.
It must be a harder sell in North America than it is in France. And this is nothing against the North American palate, but if you grew up here, this society, just your palate is going to be trained in one direction, which is just going to be different than France. Not saying one is better or worse than the other, but they are different.
Yes, they are different, but it's beautiful how fast palates change. Mm-hmm. And even mine on many, many things. And for the wines, it's the same thing. So at the end of the day, I think everyone has a path where they prefer a tendency to drier wines. So it's interesting to...
And I'll tell you, last night at the National Club, and we're taping this at the end of January, even though it's been released in February, I was hosting an Italian wine night. And the majority, we got people to vote on their favorite. What we did 3 flights, 1 white and 2 different reds. And the favorite wine was always the biggest wine, and usually the one with a little more power, a little more oak, maybe a little bit more residual sugar. So even this group of people that are huge wine collectors, the tendency still is towards a little bit bigger and maybe not as dry.
Yeah, that's true. But I've experienced many blind tastings, mm-hmm. where that is the same as well. Meaning when you have a line of 3 or 4 different wines, there's always a tendency to prefer the bigger one.
Yeah.
But if you open just one bottle, maybe it's a difficult question.
I think the false thing about when you do a blind tasting is, it's the wine out of context. It's just sipping it versus let the bottle breathe, have it with food, which is how most wine is meant to be consumed. And I think that's why if you're just going to have one sip, I think the brain is probably going to tend more towards the bigger stuff than the drier, which just takes, it's like getting into a hot tub. It takes you a couple of minutes for your body to acclimatize.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. I love blind tasting. I do it.
Yeah, it's fun.
All the time. I live for it, actually. And no, but you're right. It's difficult. So to be able to judge a wine blind is definitely tough.
It is. And it's nerve-wracking as well, especially when you're rooming professionals and, you know, you call something Bordeaux and then you find out you know it's completely wrong. There is an insecurity that goes with that.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah. I think that you'll have one moment or two of shine in your life, so when that happens, make sure everyone knows around the table.
So I want to talk a little bit about Bordeaux for a second. Also, I definitely want to talk about your family, counterfeit wine, climate change. There's a lot I'd love to get, and especially one of your family members, your grandfather, Peter. I want to talk about him because crazy story. But if you were going to describe the differences in Bordeaux between, say, like Margaux or Saint-Estèphe, Medoc. I was wondering, what are some of the major differences? Because a lot of people that are getting into wine, they're starting to learn, these vineyards are here, these vineyards are here. What is the big differences between them?
So the major differences are left bank is more gravel and clay, mm-hmm. which is perfect for Cabernet Sauvignon. So on the left bank, we plant more Cabernet Sauvignon. On the right bank, there's clay, but also a lot of limestone. And that is better suited for Merlot. So the major differences are that. Left bank Cabernet, right bank Merlot.
Can you tell the difference between a Polac and a Margaux wine?
It's very tough.
Yeah.
It's very tough. Even though it's known that Pauillac plant more Cabernet, so they have more Cabernet Sauvignon in the blend, they're supposed to be more wines that are more powerful. But at the end of the day, when you set up a blind tasting, as we just spoke about, it's really hard to spot out, and even wines between left bank and right bank.
Chateau Palmer, first, and I know the politics behind it. How the hell is it not a second growth? Because it's considered a super second, even though technically it is a third growth. It's one of my favorite Bordeaux's. It's the National Club. They do a very good job. It's always been well represented here. So I got turned on to it by being a member of the National Club. But I was wondering if you could tell the story of how the hell did this wine not have a higher status?
Yes, it's that status of that ranking happened in 1855. So when a bunch of brokers got together. And so the difference between a first growth and a second growth at that time was the price that mm-hmm. it was trading for. And in 1855, Palmer wasn't trading for, wasn't one of the stars, so that's how he got classified.
Has there ever been any thoughts to try to, because we know that with Mouton Rothschild, they politicked their way into first growth, and nothing against the wines, obviously they're delicious, but has there been any talk of Palmer doing something similar, or is it more you guys are comfortable because the reputation is there and, you know, people know who you are, no matter what the classification is?
Yes, there's no one wants to change that classification. Reputation and what we do is more important now than the classification. And that goes for both ways. So, for example, wineries would be classified today higher than their ranking and the other way around. So the most important is what you do today, and consumers are more knowledgeable, I think, today, mm-hmm. and they know.
Curious about the blend for Palmer, because as you mentioned, left bank is more Cabernet, right bank is more Merlot, but I believe it's about an equal amount blend between Merlot and Cabernet with Chateau Palmer. And the interesting thing is, if you're ever in the vineyards at Palmer, you see across 50 feet and there's Chateau Margaux, and that's around 80 to 85% Cabernet. So even though the vineyards are almost right next to each other, that is a pretty dramatic difference in blend. I'm curious about the reasons behind that.
The reason is tradition, mm-hmm. and it's been the style of Palmer for over 100 years, and we want to make sure that continues. Mm-hmm. The style of Palmer is those beautiful Merlot planted on clay and gravelly soils, so the Merlot is very lush, delicate, and that's the style of Palmer that we want to continue.
Reading recently about a lot of counterfeits that have been going on, I saw this one stat from the Interprofessional Council of Bordeaux Wines that 30,000 bottles of counterfeit imported wine are sold every hour in China alone. How do you guys deal with that? I mean, that must be something that comes up in your business plans.
Yeah, it's counterfeit is very important in China. So we have a number now of measures to protect us. We put little tags on the bottles. So if you buy a bottle, you can go on the internet, scan the little code, and you'll have a...
Really?
Yeah. You'll be able to identify when the wine was released, if it's and if it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I know that, I mean, the CIVB, so the Conseil International des Vins de Bordeaux, they invest a lot of time and money to measure the impact of counterfeit in China.
Do you have any crazy tales of counterfeit wine of any of your palmers or stories of it, you know, being 10,000 bottles were sold? Like, what are you talking about? We don't even have that. I was just wondering any crazy tales of counterfeit.
Oh, I have one. It's my uncle who sent me a bottle. Well, it's not with Palmier, but he sent me a picture, sorry. It was a few weeks ago, of Chateau Aubryon.
Yeah.
It was half a bottle in a burgundy bottle.
Oh, no.
Wait, it was screw cap.
What?
And it said Chateau Aubryon, Perpignan. So not even AOC Bordeaux.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. It was when I received it, I found it really hilarious.
Okay, let's go down this for a second. First off, shame on the counterfeiters. If you're going to commit crime, at least commit it well.
Yes.
At least be dedicated. Google for a second. So I don't know who's dumber, the counterfeiter or anyone who would buy that wine. That's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's crazy.
Oh, my God.
But I have also another story.
Yeah, go. I'd listen to all these stories.
But this is more serious. So Chateau Englouté, one of our properties in Margaux.
Yep.
And we received a bottle, and so it was a counterfeit, but it was impossible to tell the difference.
Really?
Impossible. You could not tell the difference before opening the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
So the label was perfectly done, the same quality, a nice Bordeaux bottle.
Yeah.
And you could only see with the cork, so it was not the right corks, and the wine, of course, wasn't the same, but...
So for a really good bottle, I mean, that must be scary for Seychelles and for all the iconic producers.
Yes, very scary. And for the consumer, too.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So for people listening, if they're concerned about it, I guess if it's really well done and not a Bordeaux with a screw cap and a Burgundy bottle, I guess the things to look for would be beyond, obviously, with the taste of the wine. But the cork, that would be the biggest giveaway about just that the cork wouldn't fit the wine?
Yes, cork is a good indication.
Mm-hmm.
And then just really knowing well where it comes from, making sure it's you sourced your wine correctly, where you bought it, where did your the intermediate person buy it. All that is very, very important.
Yeah. How important is it for the Bordeaux Wine Council and for wineries to make the wine-consuming public aware of good Bordeaux in the $20 to $30 range? Because for a lot of people, like this podcast, part of it is to get people into wine, make people more comfortable, relaxed, and just to drink different wines. When you hear the word Bordeaux, if you're just getting into wine, it's like you think, oh, it must be super expensive. But there's a whole, like that's only represents a tiny percentage. How important is it for the council and for you guys to communicate that you can drink a good Bordeaux and it's not going to cost you a car payment?
You're right, Matt. The Bordeaux gets all the shine from their classified growths, which represent 2% of the production. The beautiful side of Bordeaux is those wines that are between $15 to $25, which are really what is Bordeaux should be known for, as well as the top estates. I mean, very good quality for a good price, good value wines. And that's, we have, so remember that in Bordeaux, there were 7,000 wineries. 2% of them are the classified gross, but all the others produce very good value wines. And it's very important for the Conseil Inter, what you used a good word to describe the CIVB.
Oh, the Interprofessional Council of Bordeaux
Wine.
The council.
So it's very important for the council and for everyone involved in the business.
What tips would you give to people looking to buy Bordeaux? They're out there, here the giant LCBOs. Is there what vintages, areas, things? What would be some tips for people that are looking to buy Bordeaux and not spend a killer amount of money?
Well, so you guys, so you with the LCBO that controls everything, they taste a lot of wine.
Yeah.
So by the time that the wine, if the wine is chosen to be represented in the in all of the state of Ontario, it must be pretty good for Bordeaux.
Right.
And then, my honest tip is to ask the people of the LCBO mm-hmm. what they think. Because, I'm here, I've been here all week, and I've been going around all the different LCBOs and tasting the wines we have. And yeah. not from Palmer, I'm talking about Chateau Arganas, a wine that is at $18, basically.
How is it, this might be a delicate question, but anytime I travel to France or Italy, when I tell them I'm from Ontario, they always sort of shake their head a little bit and like, oh, the LCBO. What is it like working with them? I mean, there are advantages. I mean, it's one of the largest wine buyers in the world. And, you know, if your wines get there, they do have a very high quality control. But there must be challenges as well working with the LCBO.
Yes, sir. I mean, there's a lot of regulations. A lot of regulations, especially for logistics. Mm-hmm. That's the more of the annoying side of the business, but it's we've been used to it. We've been working for the LCBO for a very long time. We're always updated, mm-hmm. so now it runs smoothly. It's very smoothly.
I guess it must be easier for you guys, just larger, established, wine merchants versus, say, a young, up and coming Bordeaux producer. It must be a lot harder for them to try to crack certain markets like Ontario.
Completely, and yeah. That's what we're known for in Bordeaux. So mm-hmm. All of the history of the wine is based on the lot of the négociants. Mm-hmm. So the négociants, there are 400 in Bordeaux who sell 80% of the wine in 82 countries.
Yeah.
And so we're professionals of logistical professionals. We know the regulations in every country. So, it helps.
How do you wrestle with the idea of climate change? One of the relatives, Alain Sichel, said that over the last 15 years, climate change has helped Bordeaux reach more regularly, fully maturity of the grapes. That, you know, it's more consistent and that you're getting that maturity because in cold years, it's hard to ripen, especially Cabernet Sauvignon. So on one end, you're getting wines that are fruity, fragrant, and well-balanced. The counter side is, you know, the violent climatic episodes, you know, hail and frost. So how do you view climate change, which both seems to be a good thing, but also a negative thing for wine production?
My personal opinion is that it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
First of all, for example, at Chateau Anglidé, we've lost now two crops in a row, 17 and 18.
Which chateau is this?
Chateau Anglidé, so okay. in Margaux.
Yep.
Two crops in a row. One was frost, and the other one was mildew. Mm-hmm. There's no good sign of climate change. If the wines there's a lot of experimentations that have been done in Bordeaux.
Yeah.
So for example, if you take a row of vines and you put plastic plexiglass on top of the grapes, mm-hmm. basically it simulates a 2%, 2 degrees higher.
Okay.
In average.
Right.
And when you harvest those grapes and you vinify them separately, you see that the profile of the wine is different.
Really?
Yeah, completely.
What's the profile?
Well, more bigger wines.
Yeah.
Bigger wines, bigger, more structure. It's not the style of
more alcohol.
More alcohol levels. Yes. Yeah. Of course. And that's very important because the style of Bordeaux wines are delicious how they are.
Yeah.
And if we change the profile, that's a big challenge for us.
Actually, I haven't thought about that, but for someone like yourself who's been in wine and been on the business end and the selling end, do you see that with other wineries, that temptation to change the style, to boost up a little bit of sugar, to boost up a little bit of the alcohol, to try for easier sales, especially in New World and New World markets?
Not anymore.
No?
No, I don't
That's
think
good.
I don't think so. Yeah. Not anymore. In Bordeaux, you're allowed to chaptalize, add mm-hmm. sugar. Mm-hmm. And the last time we did that was, I think, 1991.
Really?
Yeah. Today, it's the combination of a bit of a climate change, yes, but it's mostly done to more knowledge in viticulture. Mm-hmm. And so we are able, by knowledge and work in the vineyard, to bring grapes to the right maturity.
And for people listening, chaptalization is the adding of sugar. Is it during the fermentation or just before fermentation?
During and before.
During and before. And that's done, especially in lean or cold years, to try to help boost up the body and, you know, the alcohol levels of the wine. It's allowed for a small amount, still in Bordeaux, but not since 91. That's fantastic. I would imagine that's something you guys are happy about.
Yes, you were. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Before we get, I want to talk about your grandfather, Peter Sichel, who did a memoir a couple of years ago called The Secrets of My Life, Vintner, Prisoner, Soldier, Spy. Okay, like, just for people, like, I want to get this book. He came to New York in 1941, fleeing Germany, joined the army, worked for 2 decades as a spy with the OSS and the CIA in Berlin, in Hong Kong, and then in 1959 he left and joined the family wine business. What can you tell me about your grandfather? This story is crazy.
This is a funny story, Matt, because that Peter Sichel is not my grandfather.
What? No. Oh, no.
My grandfather is also named Peter Sichel.
Oh, so this was a different book.
It's a different book, but they're cousins.
Oh, okay.
So cousins. And we've worked with Peter Max Sichel in York, who's an extraordinary human being. And
so he was like part of the family.
Yes.
He's still part of the family. We're cousins, okay. Yeah. Because, I was doing research on him. Like, I can't believe this.
Yeah.
And then I saw the memoir. So what can you tell me? What can you tell me about your cousin?
It's amazing. An amazing life he had. And, very, always very well connected in the wine business. And it's an amazing time when you spend a meal with him.
Is Blue Nun, now we're going to go through some of my,
yes.
Is Blue Nun at all part of the Sichel history?
Yes, absolutely.
What is the history of, because Blue Nun, it is a sweeter wine. I was wondering, what is the relationship with Blue Nun and Sichel?
So that's the one that we had, we launched that brand in the US, and it was, it worked really well.
Yeah.
And then we sold it.
Yeah.
But it was one of the good success stories of Sichel.
And explain that for people who don't know, because I brought up, because Blue Nun in the wine industry, you know, it's sort of, for a lot of people, it's their starter wine. It's maybe the first time they try wine is, especially here in North America, would be Blue Nun.
Yes, it's, I mean, to be honest, I think I only had the chance to try it once because it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Sugary, like very easy to get into wine, very easy profile. Yeah.
So I'm curious about what you're doing now in Southern France.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
This is a very, very passionate project.
Mm-hmm.
It's 8 hectares that my grandfather bought 30 years ago. So you have to imagine that he was my grandfather, so Peter Sichel, who was
the non-spy Peter Sichel.
The winemaker Peter Sichel. So he was producing wines in Bordeaux, very good wines. The wines were working well all over the world. But he wanted to find something in the southern France. And it took him 10 years going back and forth. So today, today, if we go down to southern France where we are, it's a 4.5-hour drive.
Yeah.
So at that time, it must have been six. And he found 8 hectares of amazing terroir, really, in the small village of Cucugnan, just before the Pyrenees Mountain.
Yep.
And it's high up in altitude. And he planted in a high-density Grenache.
Okay.
And it's absolutely phenomenal.
And so that's what you're going to be working on, high-density, high-altitude Grenache. And what would be the nearest appellation, just for people listening? Like, just geographically, where would people be able to find it?
If you come to visit, it would be next to the village of Maury.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the appellation Haute Corbière.
Mm-hmm.
And
And what was he looking for? Like, if your grandfather was going to put a checklist together in terms of the perfect terroir for Grenache, what was he looking for? What did he find?
I think my grandfather wanted to go down south because there were different problematics in Bordeaux. sometimes it was hard because of the rain. Mm-hmm. The rain and the mildew, so yeah. the mushroom that grows on the grapes and the vines. He wanted to go down south because down south it's warmer. And when you're high up in altitude, next to the Pyrenees Mountains, there's also a lot of wind. So you don't get mildew.
Yeah.
What he didn't know. So I think that's what he wanted to...
Get away from mildew.
Get away from mildew. A place where he could be alone. So it's a village of 130 people.
Yeah.
And he probably think, ah, the wine will... it would be fantastic to make wine here. And he was right. But it took... it's only now that we can see the very high potential after 30 years of...
Really?
Yes.
That must, I mean, for you, not only just, you know, a passion for wine, but, you know, this, you must have a very strong connection with family that something that started 30 years ago is now starting to finally your grandfather's dream and you get to be a big part of it. That's, that must be just very rewarding for you.
That's, it's, it really is my, I think I found my vocation.
Yeah.
It's, to show the world after 30 years that the those eight hectares that my grandfather planted in an amazing place is worth of is worthy and can be considered as one of the greatest wines of the southern France.
That's fantastic. What's the property? What's the wine called again? Just for people listening, if ever they want to try to find it.
So the wine for 30 years it's been called Château Triol.
Mm-hmm. Château Triol.
Mm-hmm. But it's the whole property is 40 acres. No, acres is 50 acres.
Mm-hmm.
50 acres. And but for 30 years we've been producing good quality, good value wines.
Yeah.
It's only recently during the past 3 years that before bottling and tasting those individual vineyards of altitude of Grenache mm-hmm. that we say, wow, there is something very special here.
That's going to be an interesting transformation from value Southern French wine to now single vineyard, old vine Grenache. That's that stylistically, that's going to be a huge jump. That's going to be, that must be fascinating.
Fascinating. And it's going to be a huge jump. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. But we're very confident because we've been the Château Triol has won over the past 30 years nearly 40 medals. It won in France the Grand Prix d'Excellence, which is given to the winery that has the most that wins the most medals during the last 3 years.
Yeah,
and we only show a white and a red, so that is very impressive. Usually, it's Les Caves Coopératives that get because they can show 20 different wines usually. And it's a very good project. So we're confident that we can produce something very, very high quality.
Just a couple more questions, then I'll let you go, because I know you got a busy day. So I don't want to end by just going over just the portfolio at Seychelles and just some of the Cole's notes for some of the wines that people can buy. But one thing in the news in Britain is everything about Brexit. And I'm just wondering what impact is that having on the European wine trade, on you guys? Will it be felt at all here in North America? Will Brexit have any impact on wine drinkers?
It's a big question mark, I think, for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
We are still having... The question mark is still... we know it's going to happen. We don't know how it's going to affect it, but it... I mean, they are still negotiating their terms,
mm-hmm.
and we'll see how we're definitely scared because England is our biggest market.
Of course, the UK, Bordeaux is their favorite.
Yeah, so we're scared, but we will adapt and we'll find solutions. We'll see how it influences us, and we'll have to adapt for sure.
So you're here. You've been trying the wines from the LCBO. For people that are listening to this that want to try, I was wondering if you could go over a little bit of your portfolio, just because I appreciate you taking the time joining me. So, you know, for people listening that want to know more about Seychelles, what's available for people to buy, especially first here in Ontario, but just some of your favorite wines.
So what's available today? So in the essential category,
yep.
So one that's always available is the Château Arganaz.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our family property. So it's located in between, so the left bank and the right bank, mm-hmm. in the Entre-deux-Mers, on one of Bordeaux's highest hills. And it's a great property because it's 60 acres, on one of Bordeaux's highest hills. And the whole goal we do at that winery is to create a natural ecosystem around it. So we have, of course, the vines, but we have chickens, beehives, fruit trees, a yep. vegetable garden. We plant different haze all around the vineyard. And the goal is to, if you arrive to produce a natural, balanced ecosystem, you don't have to use pesticides or you use them less. So we're transitioning to organic production. And it's fascinating, yeah.
That is the idea of plant beehives, and then we have to we can use less pesticides. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's a bit more complicated than that.
It's an oversimplification, but just the idea of creating the full natural ecosystem, and then you rely less on chemicals. But I always find interesting the unintended consequences. So if you do these things, then you're not going to need to use chemicals. I always find that to be just an interesting part of wine.
Yeah, it's passionate. So for example, if you want an example of direct impact, is having plants in between the vineyard. So different plants and herbs. So in between the rows of the vines, those different plants have different roots. So some roots will be like a sponge, so very compact. And that can keep the water in for when there's a bit more drought.
Yeah.
Or some roots can be very deep. And that breaks the soil, makes it breathe, more interaction. And so you don't have to go in the vineyard and you can plow less, for example. You can, and you don't go fertilizing your vineyard, basically, because those plants are a natural fertilizer as well.
What was 2018 like vintage-wise for Bordeaux? And I know some of these wines, like Palmer, we won't see them for several years before they're released. But what was 18 like?
18 was... it's funny because the big tastings of 18 will be in a couple of months. Mm-hmm. But the vintage was is a good vintage, but some suffered. And we lost a lot of wine in 18 because of the mildew.
Right.
So it was a very tough season, meaning it was raining a lot. In Bordeaux, every region has their own problems. In Bordeaux, our difficulty is the rain, the humidity.
Yeah.
So a lot of disease in the vineyard. And it was a very tough season. So very wet, a lot of mildew, small crops. But some suffered, some didn't. In Bordeaux, it's very hard to generalize as well.
Yeah.
Some regions have... you can't really generalize Bordeaux as 2018 is good. I think what will be very interesting for the 2018 vintage will be to talk with the producers, see what they've done, taste the wines, and see if you like it or not. But it doesn't mean you'll like all the 18s.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And you can always adjust the blends here or there to try to make up for if it's been a tough vintage anyway. Which is why one thing great about Bordeaux is that they can adjust to the environment around them.
Yes, they can adapt. They have a lot of different tools, different grape varieties to produce the best wine. Yeah,
Alex, I really appreciate fan. So I said I was at Chateau Palmer. It is gorgeous. I recommend to anyone to go visit. Could not have been treated better, and it was cool to go out into the vineyards, and the people picking were all like young, old men, women. There was one woman with a purple mohawk, and she was right next to some of the older gentlemen picking grapes. And it's just a beautiful part of the world. All of Margaux is so. I highly recommend Palmer. And again, congratulations on what's going on down south with some killer single vineyard Grenache. That's fantastic.
Yeah, merci beaucoup, Matt. And if you ever want to come and pick, you are welcome. Yep. We are always looking for people. So
these hands are pretty smooth. I'm more of a taster and I'm less of a picker. But actually, that would be cool for a day. Thank you so much, Alex.
Merci beaucoup, Matt.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and where all quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.